It's 4 o'clock on a Monday, and you know what that means, don't you? It's time for another exciting episode of Taxi TV Live. Yeah, baby. Hello, you guys. Good to see everybody. I'm so sorry, but I've had laryngitis for the last 3 days, so my voice, I'm drinking tea and doing cough drops. Anyway, I'm very, very excited to have an old friend who... I'll read you his bio in a moment. Today, we're going to talk about how worried should you be about AI in the music industry. And my special guest today is Mr. Todd Harriman. Double check. And see, there we are. Okay, we are broadcasting. Todd, well, I'm just going to read you his resume because it's impressive. He's an industry veteran, producer, songwriter, composer, engineer, and session musician, garnering multiple gold and platinum records. He recorded and toured for a year with Prince. His credit and client list also includes Michael Jackson, Brian Wilson, Jeff Beck, Jody Watley, and Adam Ant. Love Adam Ant. Guilty pleasure. In addition, he scored music for feature films, television, and commercials. From 2004 to 2017, he turned his attention to teaching audio engineering, producing, MIDI, and music business at Southern Illinois University. Go Salukis, right? That was the team name, that's the right. Salukis, yeah. In beautiful Carbondale, Illinois. And I just lost my place. There we go. He holds a degree in music and philosophy from Indiana University and a Master of Legal Studies from the Southern Illinois University School of Law with a concentration in intellectual property. That's why I thought he'd be perfect for the show today. He's an alumnus of the prestigious Leadership Music Program in Nashville. Todd was also the faculty advisor to Digital Dog Records, the student-run record label at SIU. The Musicians Networking Jamming Group in the Audio Engineering Society. He's organized and hosted industry panels, recording and mixing workshops, songwriting and producing seminars, and many other cool things like that. I know because every now and then I got invited to participate. Guests have included top engineers, producers, hit songwriters, and other industry executives. I guess I would fall into that category. I might still be a little sick. Todd was also the faculty audio supervisor for Studio A, the student-produced multi-camera music video production that is broadcast on WSIU-TV at Southern Illinois University. He started the summer internship program in Nashville for the College of Mass Communication and Media Arts at SIU. Todd's research interests focus on copyright issues that impact the music and entertainment industry, and his presentations and publications include topics on licensing and technology, sampling, and fair use. Also, member of NARIS, ASCAP, AES, et cetera, et cetera. And now I think you know why it is that I asked Todd to join me today. So welcome once again, Todd Harriman. How are you, buddy?
I'm good, thank you. Let me just make a short addendum to that because I left it out. In 2017, which is where the bio stops, I moved to Syracuse to teach at Syracuse University, and I currently run the music industry degree program in the School of Music and the Master's Audio Arts program for one more week. Because I'm retiring next week, so
and that's why I wanted to get you on the big show. Your swan song before you retire. Not that I wouldn't ask you back after you retire. Hang on, I'm going to make it cooler in here. Every time I start Taxi TV, the air conditioning gets warm, and these studio lights—they're killing me. Hello, everybody in the chat room. Good to see you guys. All right, so. There we go. Anyway, I asked Todd some questions, and he gave really good answers. I'm going to have him do a lot more talking than me today, just because my voice is shot. And I don't want to cough up a lung in the middle of a show, to be honest with you. I'm too vain to cough up a lung. But AI, everybody's freaking out about it. There are other YouTube channels that some are even talking about, you know, the depression, the mental anguish of AI. It's certainly something to keep a very close eye on, and it's definitely going to affect the music industry. But it's kind of like the deeper I delve into it, the less fearful I become and develop more of an attitude of, if we think about this long enough and hard enough, maybe we can come up with a way to make AI our friend. Maybe we'll find some ways while we're talking today. But I would like to ask you, Todd, to just start out and explain how AI for music works, because I think everybody just thinks of, it's a computer program that's going to rip off my music and make me obsolete. So can you elucidate, tell us literally like step one, step two, step three, yeah, how it works?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Michael, for after all these many years of you sharing your experience and expertise with my students that I get to reciprocate. So thank you. It's really a pleasure.
I'm thrilled to have you.
And to your question, there's not a simple, you know, one line answer, because I think the scope and applications for AI, including things that we haven't even witnessed yet, are so broad. So I'd like to kind of take it in a couple different views. So I think there's and having said that, I just also want to start out by saying, you know, we have heard a lot of the doom and gloom, and I think there are certainly reasons to have some concerns, and we'll get into how not only our government, but the European Union, et cetera, and the Copyright Office in the U.S., are taking a look at some of these concerns. So it's front and center. But there are also already very well documented instances of really awesome applications, uses of this technology for societal good. And you know, I'm not that technical in not only how it works, but how certain people at really high levels in tech are using it. But being in academia, I see some, you know, very clear benefits to research. And not only on the academic side, there's some concerns there too, like who's actually writing the doctoral thesis. But for medical research, even Chief Justice Roberts in his end of 2023 State of the Supreme Court talked about use of AI by the Supreme Court's law clerks, and kind of issued a warning for attorneys out there that this is a great time saver, a great research tool, but check your work. There were two lawyers in New York that had sanctions put on them because they filed a legal brief, and coincidentally the court that they filed it in, one of the citations in the brief was from the judge on the bench in that court, and the citation was wrong. So check your work. But anyway, so
I want to go back to the, it was wrong for a split second. That is called, when AI or ChatGPT specifically, they call it, it hallucinates. It
yes.
just, it yeah. makes stuff up. I had that when first day I used ChatGPT, I Googled, show me some nice things people have said about Taxi online. And it gave me these really glowing paragraphs. I thought, wow, I can't believe I've never seen that before. And the people that it was attributed to are people that don't like Taxi. So it hallucinated that. Sorry for the interruption. Please continue.
No, that's a great example. Software on acid. But seriously, so let's just take I'm not here to bash AI. I want to talk about some of the concerns that we have that are specifically related to the music industry. Examples that have been, you know, front and center in the news. We can talk about some of those issues, because I think they are good examples of why there are some concerns here. So before I kind of go down the AI rabbit hole, a couple things that I'm going to be referring to, because they're going to be either separately or entirely implicated in some of the issues that are creating concerns in the music space. And so many of you, if you've read the Passman book or you're, you know, hardcore music practitioners, this is going to be review, so you can take a 5-minute nap. There are three areas of property that I just want to use the basic language that we're going to be referring to kind of throughout our talk this afternoon. And the first are basically federal statutes, copyright statutes, that give us certain exclusive rights as authors or owners of copyrighted work. And in music, the two main copyrights that we're going to refer to, and these can be really important when we're talking about use of AI, is the composition, or what we call the underlying work. Okay, so I come up with a song, it's in my head, I don't have my recorder with me, I scribble it down on notation, on a staff, maybe with chord symbols and lyrics, whatever. So that's the composition. And then I get home, I fire up my Pro Tools rig, and I make a demo of it. And now there's a recording of that composition. The composition is protected and typically controlled by the publisher on the industry side. That's their role. And the sound recording, or we also call it the master, is typically controlled by a label. So those are two distinct copyrights. And both can be implicated in the use of AI. So we'll circle back to that in a minute. The other is, and the copyright statutes are federal law. And the other is state law. And this is an area that we're getting into some real challenges with AI replicating or appropriating or misappropriating someone's voice. Okay. So we call this the right of publicity, or ROP, which basically gives protection at the state law level to use of a celebrity's name, likeness, or image characteristics that the courts have actually deemed property rights.
So
under court law.
This goes back to me asking you the other day, what if somebody uses Tom Cruise's face on a stunt person? And, you know, so ROP, right of publicity, is that what it is again?
Correct. Yeah.
And so are you saying that gives somebody the right to do that, or does not?
No, it gives the celebrity the right to protect their name and likeness and image.
Because gotcha.
It is. Those are property rights. And there are two famous cases that are actually pretty amusing. Nothing to do with AI, but we're citing those cases a lot now because they're pretty well-known music-related right of publicity cases, both in California. And the first one was in the late 80s when Ford was doing a commercial and they wanted to kind of have a cooler, younger audience approach. So they wanted to hire Bette Midler, who was a huge star at the time, to sing one of her songs for the commercial. And she didn't do any commercial endorsements, so she turned it down. And they hired one of her backup singers, who was known as sounding a lot like Bette Midler, to sing, and told her to make it sound like Bette Midler.
Wow.
And everybody thought it was Bette Midler, so she sued, relying on her right of publicity to protect her likeness and characteristics that the court ruled as a property right. It's very identifiable. It's part of who she is.
And she won?
And she won, yeah. Fast forward a couple years later, a nearly identical case was Tom Waits sued Frito-Lay for, they asked him to sing this commercial for, you know, Frito-Lay snacks. And he doesn't do commercial endorsements, and his fans know it. He turned it down, so they hired a Tom Waits impersonator. And so it's really identical to the Bette Midler case. In fact, the Tom Waits case cited the ruling in the Bette Midler case. They misappropriated Tom Waits' voice without his consent.
But they didn't use his actual voice. They just had somebody else gargle with gravel and do a few shots of Jack Daniels, so chain smoke some cigarettes and go sound like Tom Waits.
That's actually what the judge said in the opening of the ruling, was that Tom Waits's voice was so distinctive. It sounds like somebody who drinks a fifth of vodka, smokes three packs of cigarettes and gargles with razor blades. So yeah, you must have read that ruling. But anyway, why this is important in AI. So a year ago, when the shit hit the fan, to the public anyway, when a guy that went by the handle Ghostwriter or something, and had a track that he posted, that they ended up dubbing it fake Drake, and it sounded just like Drake, and Drake's fans thought it was Drake. So that was kind of, you know, opening the floodgates of like, not only can we write songs that sound like Ed Sheeran, but we can actually have Ed singing them, but it's not really Ed.
Right.
In fact, just last week, in the feud between Drake and Kendrick, Drake put up a track that had Tupac and Snoop. And if you haven't heard it, go listen to it, because it wasn't Tupac or Snoop, but it sure as hell sounded like them.
Wow.
And so it's so taking that name and likeness on top of writing a track that sounds like what somebody else would write. So how does that happen? Let's circle back. So how does the AI work? Different platforms work differently on, you know, a really sub software side, but bottom line is we call these, you know, large language models that we have to feed a lot of data in order for them to learn. So I want them to learn how to write a song in the style of Harry Styles. So what kind of information do we feed that language model? We feed it Harry Styles songs. And there's very hardcore, you know, analysis of, you know, what intervals does he use? What tempos does he use? Okay, so that's using the underlying work, the composition copyright, to train the model to write a song like Harry would write. Question, do you need permission from the publishers of all those songs to use it for training purposes? This is kind of a fundamental intellectual property question now that the rights holders are saying, you know, we're not okay. Publishers are not okay. National Music Publishers Association has been very vocal about this. You can't use our songs to train. I call it training your dog. It's you know, training your ChatGPT or whatever platform you're using to kick out songs like the ones I own. You need my permission to do that. How we're going to do that, I don't know. We can come back to that question in a little bit. And then, so there's the issue of using that piece of property, the composition, without permission. And then not only do we have a song that's written in the style of Harry Styles, we want it to sound like Harry Styles is singing it. So what do? We feed your platform recordings of Harry Styles, so they can mimic Harry's voice, just like Snoop. Listen to the Snoop thing. It sounds just like him, and it's not Snoop. So this stuff has gotten pretty good. So one of the fears is it's pretty good now, and it's only going to get better. And now it's learning from itself, you know? So this is obviously cause for concern. So those
explain two... learning from itself, Hal.
Yes. Open the hatch door, Hal. So obviously record labels and publishers on the federal copyright level, and then the right of publicity, the artists that are having their voice misappropriated if it's without their permission. So those are kind of the concerns. And I think actually, again, without painting all this as doom and gloom, it's a very real concern.
It's a real concern, but it's so complex And I've made this statement probably on Taxi TV before, and my own personal feeling as of today is that the technology, the development of what it can do, is far outpacing the legislation that will protect the rights holders. Therefore, the people with the technology, certainly in the professional realm, TV networks, record labels, etc., Spotify, they're going to try really hard not to, by intent or even accidentally, use AI-created music until the legal side of it is settled, because hypothetically, NBC could have every show on their network for a year, just to make kind of a large-scale example, could have AI-generated music, and then some law is passed that makes it highly illegal. They would have to go back, strip out the music, and put new music in, much like they did when they released CD or DVD box sets, and they didn't have the rights to some of the music that they used for the, you know, the broadcast iteration of the show. So that in and of itself, to me, provides at least some short to midterm protection for the people watching the show and other musicians.
Well, I guess it depends on the actors, and I don't mean that as far as the actors and actresses. I mean, you know, the corporate actors. There are some good ones out there and some bad ones out there. And so let me take that, let's say, NBC sitcom as an example and just run a little bit further with it.
Okay.
Not only putting the music in it, what about the script writing?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What about the generation of the images? The real life, New York Times did a piece on this a couple months ago where they had input to ChatGPT, basically asking for characters like, you know, a character from Batman or a character from Lord of the Rings. And without taking a still from the movie, what AI generated, they put up actually a still from the movie and what ChatGPT generated, and they were nearly identical.
Wow.
I mean, the average person on the street would say, well, that's right out of the movie. So when we look at the applications of this, you know, for something like a TV show or a movie, I have a friend in Chicago who is a fabulous musician, but also a Civil War expert. And he was telling me a couple of weeks ago that there's a new video AI platform that they're starting to use like in documentaries. And he told me that they were making a documentary about a certain period of the West in like the early 1800s. And this video AI platform literally recreated the town down to the square foot of what it looked like back in 1810.
And what kind of data did it have to scrape to find out those measurements, you know, and the plat map of the town and everything?
Yeah, photographs, topography, verbal descriptions. Yeah, there's a lot of data scraping going on. But he said, and I haven't seen this, but I think just to the point, that this stuff's getting pretty good. And we look at something like that, even from making a historically based documentary. I think that's really awesome that you can actually be on the set of this thing. But again, circling back to maybe bad actors, let me just kind of take a left turn and talk about, you know, Michael, you did brought up, you know, legislative action sometimes can be way in the back seat. This is so front and center, and it's moving so quickly. There is a lot going on in the legislative space. In March of this year, the European Union passed the Artificial Intelligence Act, and this has been from a proposal that goes back 3 years. And just a real quick quote from the Act. The Act places a number of legal and transparency obligations on tech companies and AI developers operating in Europe, including those working in the creative sector and music business. So what they're looking at doing is say a core requirement that companies using generative AI or foundation AI models like ChatGPT or Anthropic's Claude 2 that they provide detailed summaries of any copyrighted works, including music that they've used to train their systems. So that puts a pretty big burden on the people that are generating content from these platforms that they're going to have to submit, and I don't know how this is going to be enforced, detailed summaries of the copyrighted works. So, Michael, you had asked a question in our chats leading up to this. Well, that could be hundreds or thousands of songs.
Millions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Again, how are you going to implement this? How are you going to enforce it? I don't know. Let's just take that and run with it for just a little bit. How might we be able to do that? So I think this is something that's clearly going to have to be done on the blockchain, right? How are we going to be able to track this? We need that monster ledger that's going to be able to be, you know, the spreadsheet of mother spreadsheets that says this is every single song that was used in generating this a la Harry Styles song.
And will it be able to track or display, you know, that 1/16 of 1/10 of 1% went into the snare sound, 2.3% went into the vocal sound, 4.9% was the melodic content. I mean,
I don't know. Look at what streaming royalties, because this the payout per stream is so small, and then you have, you know, songs that you know, were co-written by 10 writers that all have co-pub deals, so there are 20 publishers, and then there are a couple samples in there, add another 10 publishers and writers, and multiply that times, you know, a couple hundred for this. So I think,
Mom, I co-wrote a hit song. Can I borrow $5 to go buy French fries?
yeah. So I don't have an answer for you there, but something along those lines. Maybe we'll have, I mean, look, in the last at least 20 years, we have Sound Exchange came out to start being able to handle digital royalties for the sound recording. We didn't have that before. A couple of years ago, because of the Music Modernization Act, they formed another collection organization called the Mechanical Licensing Collective to collect and distribute interactive streaming mechanical royalties. We're going to need another organization to oversee and implement this. I have no idea what it's going to look like, but that's what this European legislation is looking at. Fast forward to January of this year, there's a House bill. I love this. Pardon me if I have to poke fun at Congress for a little bit. They give us plenty of turn the microphone off, Michael. They give us plenty. There's a black van parked across the street from my house.
And a red dot on your forehead.
So I think oftentimes Congress sits around spending more time coming up with sexy acronyms for their legislation than they actually spent on the legislation itself. So get this one. The latest one for AI in Congress, right, in the House, is called the No AI Fraud Act. Now, what do you think No AI Fraud, an acronym, could read? I'll tell you, no artificial intelligence, fake replicas, and unauthorized duplications act. Okay, so that's in front of Congress, and they're saying, going back to not only right of publicity, they say that this will be federal jurisdiction that will reaffirm that anyone's likeness and voice is protected and give individuals the right to control the use of their identifying characteristics. So that's in front of Congress. That was on the heels of the Senate bill last fall in October called No Fakes Act. Okay, so what's the acronym No Fakes stand for? Anybody? Bueller?
Took a minute, but I got it.
Yeah. Well, I thought you did a Ferris Bueller quote earlier about coughing up a lung. So that was a Ferris Bueller.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
So anyway, No Fakes Act. Nurture Originals, Foster Art, and Keep Entertainment Safe Act.
Say that again.
Yeah, nurture originals, foster art, and keep entertainment safe.
Who comes up with this crap? Oh my God.
That's my point. One of my favorite ones. So this goes back to, it's not AI, but acronyms for legislation. So there's a copyright royalty board that sets certain rates, like streaming rates, performance rates, things like that. And they have an arbitration panel to settle disputes. And what the real panel title was Copyright Royalty Arbitration Panel, which was crap. And so they just couldn't do that. So they changed it to Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel, which makes no sense, but it couldn't be crap. So that's what our tax dollars do. So anyway, so we have two bills in Congress dealing with the same kind of things that the European Union just passed. I also want to mention that, so the Copyright Office, so if you write a song, your copyright now exists from the moment of creation.
Right.
So not when it's in your head, but when you've written it down or you've put it on a hard drive, that's when the copyright duration starts. And the current duration is life of the author plus 70 years. So, but to get the full protection, so we have six exclusive rights in our copyright statutes that are given to the authors, that they can assign those rights to other people. Like if you're a songwriter and you assign your copyright to Sony Music Publishing. Now, Sony is the publisher and the owner of that piece of work. But for you to get full protection of your exclusive rights, the right to make copies, the right to make derivative works, the right to distribute, et cetera, you need to file a registration with the Copyright Office, which is in the Library of Congress. Because if somebody rips you off, they steal your song, you can't sue them if you haven't registered it with the Copyright Office. So about 2 years ago, somebody tried to register an image that was AI generated and said so on his registration. And the Copyright Office rejected the registration, saying that authorship has to be human.
I hear that all the time. The question is why? If you gave it the directives vis-a-vis prompting it, and it created what you asked it to create, why couldn't they ascribe that ownership of original whatever to you? I'm glad it is that way, but I don't understand why.
Well,
I'll
give you a couple examples. And they're non-AI related, but I think they're going to come into the discussion. So the first part is the actual act of creation. You are giving prompts, but you are not creating the actual work. You have input into that creation. So maybe the question is, should there be partial ownership allowed?
Yeah, you and I co-writing a song and I say, try saying, she left me in a cold, dark place. And you go, how about if I say she left me in a back alley? There's collaboration there that fostered the ultimate end product. So now you would be hypothetically collaborating with a robot, but yeah.
And I think there is a distinction there that if you and I are kind of kicking those ideas around, the authorship in even kicking around those ideas to get to the end result is still human authorship. So I think that is a distinction that the Copyright Office and Europe, actually the European Union, has agreed on. And I think it's really more a policy issue than a legal issue.
Okay.
So there was a famous, this is always one of my, I use this in my copyright lectures. I don't know if you saw it 10 years ago at least, maybe it even goes like 2008 or something like that. There was a British photographer that went to Indonesia to photograph a monkey that was on the endangered species list. It's called, I think, a macaque monkey. And the monkey was very intrigued by the snapping sound of the photographer taking pictures. And the photographer set his camera down, and the monkey picked the camera up and snapped a selfie. And it's a fabulous picture. He's really more like the size of a gorilla, and he has these huge, big amber eyes, and he's smiling, and he has these big teeth, and it's just a beautiful picture. And the photographer put it up on his website and told the story of the monkey taking the picture. And then there was a wiki site for endangered species that took the photograph and put it up on their wiki site as a picture of one of their endangered species. And the photographer sent him a takedown notice, just like we would send YouTube a takedown notice. Mm-hmm. You don't have permission to use my photograph. And the owner of the wiki site said, it's not your photograph. So a lawsuit actually occurred. I follow a lot of legal blogs. And the copyright office has chimed in on this, that authorship needs to be human. And then, believe it or not, PETA got involved.
Oh, my gosh.
For the ethical treatment of animals, saying that animals should have a property right. So anyway, but
I'm all for keeping animals safe and not harming them, but sometimes PETA just goes way off the reservation. This is one of those.
Yeah. So, but the point is that, so if authorship has to be human, okay, whether it's, you know, a non-human animal or ChatGPT, from a policy standpoint, now that's where it stands. Here's an interesting kind of follow-up to that. A book author had written a book, and he actually wrote the narrative, the text, but all the images in the book were AI generated. This is recent. This was, I think, late last year, sometime last year. And he went to register the copyright for the book in the copyright office, and the copyright office responded, "We will protect and register your text, but you can't protect your images." So they made that distinction, okay, in that example. So
I wonder if the book's publisher backed out, you know, we want half of the advance back because the images weren't yours.
Yeah. Trying to see. The other thing I had made a note of is that, so you mentioned, you know, Tom Cruise having his face put on, you know, the actor of, you know, so much for the stunt double. What the actors have been so concerned about is that, you know, the film companies already have plenty of data, raw data footage of the actors. Can they use the images of these actors in a new, you know, a new movie where the actors aren't even present? And so do the actors have to give their consent? Do the actors get paid for this new movie that they didn't actually act in? So the writer's strike last year, part of the settlement was very much about using AI for script generation. We need to protect the writers. The actors, SAG and AFTRA, those unions, were very supportive of the writers because of very similar issues that could flip it. You know, it's going to come back. The same issue is going to affect the actors and actresses. And just last week, there was the announcement that SAG and AFTRA finished recent agreements with the film production companies. When I saw the article, SAG and AFTRA, the members had not ratified it yet, but they had basically finished the negotiations.
If I may interject for a moment, I heard that as well while I was stuck in traffic on the 101 Sunday. And I remember thinking that, but they have SAG and AFTRA, the actors, the writers, they have unions, they have lobbying power. Musicians don't. Yeah, there's a musicians union, but it's not even close to having the power that, you know, SAG and AFTRA have. But then I realized they've fought the battle for us, for the music community because precedents have been set. And therefore, even though the music community doesn't have a champion in the form of SAG-AFTRA, you could make the argument ASCAP and BMI would certainly have a vested interest in helping to fight the battle, as would publishers. But the precedents have been set in these strikes and ultimate settlements. So there's that.
Yeah, and even the AFFM very recently concluded negotiations with the film companies for film music, including AI.
Really? So, can you elucidate what they, any fine points on the AI aspect of that?
Yeah, well, film company could easily train the model to write a score in the style of John Williams and not have to hire a composer. And take that, just also very, very current. Do you know Dave Pomeroy? Is that the head of the Musicians Union in Nashville?
No, I know the name. I don't think I've ever met him.
So really, really active in Nashville. And Tennessee just passed. Oh, I got to come up with this one, too. I'm not sure if I have it. But so Tennessee, a couple weeks ago, passed the Elvis Act. While we're talking about acronyms, I can't let this one go. Give me a second.
All right. Nothing better than a good acronym. For those of you who joined us late, I've had laryngitis for the last couple of days. It's getting better, but I'm drinking a lot of tea and eating a lot of cough drops and don't sound that good today. So there you go.
Okay. Okay, you ready for this one?
Yep.
Elvis, Ensuring Likeness, Voice, and Image Security Act.
Wow.
That's the acronym.
And
they
yet
came
they,
up with it.
And yet they used his name.
Well, I would have. See, here's something that's also really interesting. Let me go back to write-up publicity really quick.
I'm turning the page to get back to that for that very reason, please.
So I'll come back to the Tennessee Act because Tennessee just passed legislation called the Elvis Act. And, okay, we'll come back to what that meant. But write-up publicity, one of the challenges we have, so, you know, actors, actresses, musicians, Bette Midler, Tom Waits, have right of publicity rights, okay? But it's state law, and those ROP rights vary widely from state to state. Which states do you think have the most rigid ROP laws? California, Tennessee, and New York. Go figure.
Right? Yeah.
And Tennessee is because of Elvis and Nashville. You can't do Elvis impersonations in Tennessee.
Really?
And in Vegas. Yeah. Yeah. So again, it's state law, and the Elvis camp has worked really hard to maintain their control over Elvis's likeness. To run the ROP discrepancy between states even further, Delaware has no ROP at all. So question, where are you going to sue? Well, sue in California, you know. One of the things that I think that is going to evolve into is creating a federal right of publicity. And we're starting to lean towards that, even with that that House bill to reaffirm that everyone's likeness and voice is protected. That's the language in the bill. That's leaning towards creating a federal right of publicity. So it would be across.
Boy, what a can of worms, because what if somebody is imitating Elvis in New York, but it's being live streamed or broadcast on a TV network to all 50
sure.
states?
Yeah.
You know, does it have to be created in a state that's got an ROP law? And don't anybody send any letters or anything, but this kind of goes back to, you know, abortion, states' rights or federal laws. I mean, it gets complicated.
Well, wow. That would kind of sew it up where we wouldn't have that the discrepancies be between the states. So I think we'll see that. Let's see what acronym they come up for that one.
Yeah, a visit to the Supreme Court, I think, on that one.
Let's not go down that path right now. the Elvis Act in Tennessee basically was put in place because of AI, and this was more about performances. So it's kind of like 40 years after sampling was invented. It's not sampling, but it's opening up a lot of the same issues about taking somebody's performance and using it in AI. So that's what the Musicians Union was getting behind. So again, it's not sampling, but it's kind of sampling on steroids.
Wow. It's so complex. Let's talk about, in the context of the music industry and current models like or products like Suno, or what's the new one, Audio or something that just came out?
Audio, I think it is.
And Suno. Okay, so I was out to dinner with the in-laws about 3 weeks ago, and my daughter's father-in-law played a song that he created for one of his younger daughters on Suno, and I gotta say, it sounded almost like a pop hit. It was very, very impressive. I would have, as a producer, I would have done more to flesh it out more, but the bones were absolutely there. Melodically, lyrically, they gave it some prompts like, she's a good kid, always, you know, makes her bed in the morning, whatever they said about her. And it got that stuff in there and it made sense and was pretty darn good. So I brought up the topic of Suno amongst staff members here at Taxi, and one of the staff members said, yeah, you know, I tried to break it by asking it to do like accordion metal. And I said, well, the goal right now is to maybe not try to break it, but understand it. And he made a comment, which I found interesting, which was, I'm paraphrasing here and trying to remember it pretty exactly. But he said, you know, all the pop punk stuff, for instance, that I asked it to do, all sounded very homogenous, like it was created maybe by the same band, same musician, same studio, same producer. And that's when I realized they're trying to avoid getting sued early in the game and getting shut down, having a Napster moment. So they're probably not gathering data from all over the world, you know, every piece of music that's been created. I mean, they would have had to start that project some time ago. So they're probably working with a limited data set. In other words, a limited number of songs that they know they've got a legal right to use for this purpose. And maybe that's why that stuff sounded homogenous. But what if somebody goes out there and samples music globally for decades in arrears?
Well, it's how it works is that you don't have to, you feed it prompts and then your platform scrapes the web. So it's not like you have to have a library of 1,000 sounds. The platform goes and does that for you.
Wow. So, but how can it effectively do that so fast? I mean, it'd be one thing to assemble it. I imagine there was a library that it assembled these components from. So it's actually in real time going out there and scraping the web.
Yeah, how long it takes is going to be dependent on the complexity and amount of your prompts. But here's an example, and this is, I think, on the positive application. I have a student who's graduating who was selected to do an honors thesis. And he's a songwriter and performer. And he wanted to do his thesis incorporating AI as a lyric tool, not to actually generate the lyrics, but he would feed chat. He was using ChatGPT and he would feed it a story and then give it prompts that he wanted it to take the narrative and give suggestions for use this word, not that word. And so he's not saying, hey, give me lyrics like Harry Styles. He's saying, here is my story, my memory when I was a kid sitting in the back seat of my car, his parents' car, while they were listening to the radio and hearing Marvin Gaye. And he wanted to write a song about that childhood memory. And so his paper is actually talking about the prompts that he used, not being fully satisfied with the results, making the prompts more detailed, and then comparing the results. I mean, it was fascinating. So to me, I look at that as, you know, one songwriting tool is, you know, I don't know if you even need this anymore, given it's all online, but not AI, but, you know, songwriters will have a thesaurus, right? Mm-hmm. So this was kind of his thesaurus. Is how he was using ChatGPT, not to write the song for him, but as a tool to make suggestions for him. And I thought that was great. A couple other things talking about, I think, positive uses. So, you know, finishing John Lennon's cassette that was found, the Now and Then example. Did the song bring me to tears? No, but I loved hearing his voice, first of all. And that they could actually do it, that they could actually finish the song. I thought that was great. Michael, I don't know if you happened to see this headline from last week, but a family in Brussels found, because somebody in their family, it was given to them by Marvin Gaye, like 40 cassettes with unheard Marvin demos, 65 no. new songs from Marvin Gaye.
How did somebody in Brussels end up with that?
Well, Marvin lived with this guy in Brussels when he was kind of getting clean. And it was like a friend of his that when he left, he said, you know, this is like my gift to you. And it sat under a rock for 35 years. Can you imagine? We can maybe have another 5 Marvin Gaye albums. And an attorney that was representing the family just said, there's some serious stuff on this.
Now, you actually saw this headline or did you hear it through the grapevine?
No, it was, I think it was like in Billboard, the Music Business Worldwide.
Right over here. I heard it through the grapevine? Or no?
Yeah, you're right. Back up. Let's replay that.
We'll get it in post.
Can you hit the applause button on your desk? Give what up for Michael Lascow.
Yeah. Here, I've got the perfect thing.
I remember those on your desk 20 years ago. Anyway, so... No, I didn't hear it through the grapevine, but
that's unbelievable. You know, I would say he's in my top 5 artists. That if somebody was going to unearth a trove of those treasures, he would be right up there, man. Just awesome.
I hope so. So, you know, positive use of AI. And I don't know specifically how much AI stuff was used in Peter Jackson's, doing Get Back. But I thought the restoration of that was freaking incredible. Just great.
I literally sat right in front of my 55-inch TV. My wife and kids were out of town, so one weekend I watched the whole thing and sat there a foot away from the TV and felt like I was in the room with them. It was mind-blowing.
Yeah, so I think applying these kind of things to finish projects like that, God... You know, Prince, he doesn't need any AI because so much of his stuff was finished on the spot. So of those 8,000 songs in his vault, my guess is that many of them would be release ready. Michael Jackson's catalog, I mean, the stuff that is sitting in a vault, again, just treasure trove. I don't know what they would need to do. I hope they don't finish Michael's vocals with AI. Let's hear what Michael actually did. So that personal opinion, I don't need to hear it generated. I want to hear what Michael actually did, even if it's, you know, if the vocal is incomplete. I think this Marvin Gaye stuff to clean up the tapes, You know, let's talk about production side of AI. I mean, there are plugins that have very effectively used learning. And so what is that going to do for our engineering students 10 years down the road? Is engineering going to become a lost art? You're an engineer. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it will become a lost art unless people... You know what? There are people who paint with brushes made with horsehair using oil paints because that's what they love and they're passionate about, and that's the way they choose to do it. There are other people that do art with computers. So I think both can exist happily. I mean, I'm a little prejudiced in that I'm a mic and wires guy, as you well know, but I'm blown away by some of the plugins that I've either tried or read about or seen videos of on YouTube. So yeah, I think it's a little sad that the kids coming up today, kids in engineering, you know, rather than turning an equalizer to get a snare sound or moving a microphone, just combine 7 or 8 snare drums to get the sound they want. But you know what? That's the way the kids do it today. So be it.
Well, I think, you know, I think what we should do, anybody just starting out as an engineer, is that we should lock them in a room with a, you know, with an analog console and a patch bay and say, you figure it out. You know, I'll let you out when you got something. Well, I didn't lock the door on them, but I used to teach that. I took their Pro Tools away. We used Pro Tools instead of a tape machine, but you know, everything had to be an analog back into Pro Tools. And I had students that objected, said, come on, I've been using Pro Tools for 5 years. And I'd give them, you know, signal flow exercises, and they couldn't do it because you can do stuff totally wrong and still get an outcome.
Right.
In the box. You can't on a console and a patch bay. If you fuck up the patching, you're not going to get it to where you want it to go. So I found in every single case when I forced them to learn signal flow through a physical console, when they went back to Pro Tools, they were 10 times more efficient in their routing. So I think there's some, I mean, I learned on an analog modular synthesizer, and now I can buy, you know, a synth with 1 million patches in it that I used to have to build from scratch.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not teaching somebody how to build a patch anymore. Just like, let me just cycle through, you know, all the patches. So what I found in the analog world is that when I made them turn the dial on an 1176, I think there is still some psychological, physiological component to that tactile moment that affects the brain when it forces you to hear that chain. You know, versus somebody hands in a project, and I'm not getting down on young, you know, students that are learning the craft, hopefully. I just think there are ways to teach it that might connect those functions in a more real and meaningful way.
If I ever have enough time in my life to sit down and really learn logic, I want to buy the SSL stuff, the physical manifestations.
It's gotten good.
Yeah, it's like, I love the feel of SSLs. There is something, I don't want to say it's sexual, but it's gratifying when you feel the quality of the knob and you turn it and you get a change in what you're hearing. I'm sure that triggers some sort of response in your whatever area of your brain recognizes pleasure. An accomplishment. And so, yeah, I would be a lot more driven to delve deeper and learn faster on Pro Tools or Logic if I had an interface like that, because I'm telling you, that's the one thing for the 50 hours I've spent playing, maybe 100 hours by now playing with Logic, I hate mousing over stuff. It just takes all the fun out of it.
Yeah, we can have the best of both worlds, you know. I agree. Just one last thing on the plugin side. Isotope has some fabulous plugins, and they have some learning scenarios of their software where you can put a plugin you know, and the plugin will look at your tracks and make predictive suggestions. I think that's fine to a point and can certainly speed up your workflow. The thing that I've always been concerned about with the plugin side versus the analog side, and I've witnessed it with students, is that when they can just call up presets, you know, on a plugin, especially when they're starting up, they're not listening. They just slap a compressor on it and the threshold is set too high, the compressor's not even kicking in. So are you listening to, it's not working. So as long as we, you know, keep listening and listening for what's going on, and if the predictive stuff, and it's only going to get better, but I think we still need to know the fundamentals so we know, even know what that predicting is actually doing.
Yeah. A really good friend of mine, you know what, if you're ever out in LA, the three of us should go out and grab dinner. He was a leading audio restoration person at Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers Pictures, I think, or maybe Warner Brothers TV. He would be a great guy to talk to about how AI could do that. Make it faster. Maybe not better than a human. Maybe, maybe not. But definitely faster, because it's very fastidious work.
Yeah.
Are you up for taking some questions? We have 29 minutes left, and there have been a lot of questions in there. So,
folks, great.
Yeah, if you guys would be kind enough to type the word question in all caps just so it pops out a little bit more in the chat for me, and I will relay questions to Todd. And Todd, this is, it's fascinating. There's so many people out there that really kind of haven't dug in as deeply as you have that have opinions. And unfortunately, they're getting some airtime, and I believe that much like news in the media, you know, that's not sourced well or not verified, rumors can spread. And so I'm glad we're getting some opinions from somebody that's done the homework. Thank you.
Yeah. And one thing I would suggest to your audience, and perhaps many of them are already doing so, but so I bring this stuff into the classroom every single day. I start out with current events. And so that forces me to try to stay on top of that. And it's actually one of the hardest parts of my job is to stay on top with how fast this stuff is moving. But Music Business Worldwide, it's free. Get their newsletter. Just go to musicbusinessworldwide.com, scroll down on the right, enter your email. They're great. I mean, what a great resource. I hesitate to encourage people just so blindly to go out and spend money. But I do find the digital subscription to Billboard is still really helpful.
Mm.
It's $100.
I read Music Biz Worldwide. Let me look really quickly. I subscribe to a couple of AI newsletters that are not music industry specific. And I shut down my mailbox. I don't know. I'll feature them in one of our upcoming newsletters. The problem is I now spend 2 hours a day every morning. My day starts usually around 7 a.m., maybe 7:15, maybe 6:30, answering a crap ton of emails. And then once I feel like, okay, I've gotten all the rigmarole out of the way, I jump in the shower, come to the office around anywhere between 10 and 11 typically. Now AI has screwed up my schedule because in the morning, the two AI newsletters I'm reading, it's like every day somebody's got, there are five new products every day and you can't just read a headline about it. You've got to go check it out or watch a video about it.
Yeah. Hey, Michael, I want to get to questions. Just one more thing I wanted to add. So you mentioned Udio, and actually there was an interesting newsletter that was published on Music Business Worldwide. The head of Udio basically just, you know, moving full speed ahead and saying that any use of protected material in the training side of AI is fair use. So we didn't talk about fair use.
Oh, let's talk about fair use for a minute.
Okay.
What is the definition of fair use specifically within the context of this?
Okay. Well, just the notion of fair use is that we have these protected rights for the authors, the creators, which include things like you can't make copies without a license or permission, you can't make derivative works, you can't distribute. However, certain uses of protected material without permission should be excused. And Congress in 1976 passed the Fair Use Statute, part of the copyright statute, that basically outlines a four-part test that will hopefully help one determine whether or not this use without permission should be excused. And so, I mean, there are tons of fair use cases in the music world. The most famous one is probably the Two Live Crews parody of Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court because Two Live Crew did their spoof on Roy Orbison's song without permission. In fact, they were denied permission, but they put it out anyway.
Wow.
And they got sued by Orbison's publisher, Acuff Rose, in Nashville. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And many, even attorneys, mischaracterize what the legal issue in front of the court was. And in that case, the appellate court ruled that it can't be fair use because of Two Live Crew's commercial nature, that they did it as a commercial endeavor. And that's only the first part of the four-part test. And the Supreme Court said, no, you have to run the whole test. So they threw it back to the lower court, and then the party settled, so we don't have a ruling on it.
Wow.
But the legal issue was not to have the court determine whether or not it was a parody. The legal issue was whether or not the commercial nature would bar a fair use defense. Another one, sampling is almost always a slam dunk, because what you have to show to prove infringement is that the alleged infringer had access and that there's substantial similarity. Well, if you took a sample, you obviously had access. You took a recording. You didn't do a sound alike, you took the recording. And is it substantially similar? It's an exact copy.
Yeah.
So sampling is usually a slam dunk. However, there's a Drake case a year or two ago. He had a song called Pound Cake, where he started it out with a sample of the jazz musician Jimmy Smith talking about how jazz is the only real true American music form, everything else is bullshit. And Drake's like, fuck that. So he puts up this quote from Jimmy Smith at the beginning of his rap track, kind of saying, you know, flipping the bird to Jimmy Smith. And the Jimmy Smith's estate sued him for taking the sample. He had permission for the recording. Remember the two copyrights? You have to clear the recording and you have to clear the underlying work. Well, this was just an interview, so it wasn't a song, but the court viewed the text of this interview as lyrics, the underlying work. So that's what Drake was getting sued for. And the first test, the first factor in the fair use statute is the purpose and character of the use. Why did you take it? And if something is very transformative, sufficiently transformed in meaning, that could be highly transformative and the court will give you a pass. So there was Andy Warhol did a series of Prince posters based on a photograph that a woman took in the early 80s of Prince. And Warhol had permission to make one print for a cover, I think, of Vanity Fair or something like that. And he ended up making a series of 16 prints, and the photographer sued him, said you didn't have permission to do that. And the Warhol Foundation said, well, it was highly transformative of Prince's photo. And the court said, no, it wasn't. It's just a colorized version. So you don't get a pass on that one. So anyway, the notion of fair use is some uses without permission should be excused. And so you might get sued, and that might be your only defense. So if Weird Al got sued for, you know, ripping off somebody else's songs, I've had him speak to my class and he says, no, I have to have permission because my label won't let me put it out. I can't risk getting sued. Claiming it was fair use, like, you know, the Roy Orbison case. So,
well, we're going to run into this again, going back to NBC. I'm not picking on them in particular, but yeah, the networks aren't going to want to risk using AI generated music because of the legal issues that could befall them and everybody else in the chain. But what about, let's say you're a taxi member and you use AI to create something, you submit it, the screener really has no way to know if that was generated by AI, if it's a good one, gets forwarded, gets in the hands of a library that doesn't know that's AI generated, and now it ends up on NBC because somebody told a little fib and said, I own the copyright for the underlying composition and the sound recording. There you go.
Yeah, watermarking is going to be a big deal. So how do we have a digital watermark as part of the metadata that, yes, this was AI generated and here's the stuff that was used? I don't know. Files might start getting pretty big.
Wow. All right. Let's do some questions. Here, I'm going to go back and grab some from people that were already nice enough to post them. Paul Croteau, court has ruled that you cannot copyright AI generated songs. But if I use AI to create a song, then re-record all the instruments and vocal, is it now my song and is it copyrightable? That's a good question.
Yeah, great hypothetical. So breaking it down, if I understand the steps. So you AI generated a song for you. So what might be at issue legally on the copyright side or right of publicity? So the question is, and we really haven't had court rulings saying that yet, that the songs used to train your platform you used without protection. There's still the argument, is that fair use or not? So we have two parts to the AI. One is the input. What did you input to get that output? So the first question is, do you need permission to for songs on the input side to train your platform? And then the output, well, if it sounds substantially similar, that's the legal term, so access and substantially similar to a prior work. Well, if you put that Harry Styles group of songs in there, you obviously had access to Harry Styles songs. And then the output is substantially similar to a Harry Styles song. The underlying work, okay, so forget about having Harry Styles sound alike singing it, just the underlying work. Take Ed Sheeran with his recent case last fall with Thinking Out Loud and the Marvin Gaye song. Ed said there are all these components that are fundamental building blocks in Western music, in particular pop music, that you can't copyright. So we have in popular music unprotected elements like a 1-4-5 chord, a 12-bar blues, things like that, that you can't own it, okay? You can't claim that. But what about the things that are protected, that unique Gershwin-like melody that I only hear from Gershwin? Highly protected, highly original, because that's the bar for copyright protection. So back to your question, if the song that it spits out in the lyrics and melody, let's just focus on melody for a second, are substantially similar to an earlier prior work, you might be getting yourself into infringement. Now, your other part of the question is you go and re-record all those parts, mm-hmm. but the melody is still the same. It's your melody that might be infringing in this case. Okay, if you re-record all the parts, then you've created your own sound recording and you're probably in fair territory there that you own the recording, you haven't taken somebody else's recording. It doesn't mean that the record labels aren't upset with you for using the recording to train your model, okay? So that's a deeper question that we don't have the answers to yet. But as far as, is your melody too close to a work that you use to train your platform? And even if you re-record it, you still have the underlying work issue. I hope that answered the question.
Yeah, it did. And thank you for that, because I've heard this discussed elsewhere and nobody has ever, you're absolutely right. The recording is a new recording that you've generated. But if you are using the melody and the lyric that are part of the underlying composition, that's a separate, wow.
Yeah, this, I'm serious. We could talk for days about this.
Yeah, this is, it's complex.
And people said that, you know, when this, the shit kind of hit the fan a year ago with the fake Drake, that this is the new Napster. I think this is, you know, way beyond. When we're talking about Napster, we're talking about downloading a song where maybe, you know, well, we are infringing on the publisher side and the label side. That's one song. Here we're generating a new song, and we might be implicating hundreds of rights holders.
You know, I'm glad that you brought that the Napster thing up, and I'm not judging anybody, but the chorus of, oh my gosh, this is going to ruin my career in music, you know where I'm going with this. All the people that are worried about it, complaining about it, upset about it, probably had substantial libraries of illegally downloaded music vis-a-vis Napster. So there's a little irony in that.
Well, and there is. And I talk about irony, is that the very thing that the labels tried to shut down 20 plus years ago is the very thing that has saved their asses in the last 10 years. At least that technology, you know, of the ability to easily transmit a digital file.
Now, our mutual friend Jim Griffin always said, the minute you find a way to make music feel like it's free, people will quit stealing it. Spotify was the answer to that. Nancy Kalel has a question. Who are the Congress people sponsoring the bills that were mentioned? Are they musicians?
Oh, good question. Let me see if I have that. I know on the articles, let me call this up real quick, because I think the article, I got to cut and paste here a second real quick. Okay. Give me a second, Nancy. Let me go to another page here. I'll be right with you.
I'm looking for another question while you're doing that.
So, Nancy, the no AI fraud was introduced by Representatives Maria Elvira Salazar from Florida and Madeline Dean from Pennsylvania, Nathaniel Moran from Texas, Joe Morrell, New York, Rob Whitman, Virginia. So that's the House bill. It doesn't say that any of them are musicians, but I think it's certainly a musician-friendly act, if that answers your question.
Right. Well, to a point, yeah. I can't remember his name, but a famous senator from Tennessee. I went on a lobbying trip one time. I can't remember, one organization or another called, said, would you join us for a lobbying trip to D.C.? And literally, we broke up into groups of like three or four people and went down through the halls of Congress and the Senate, meeting with Congress people and senators. And gosh, what was his name? Famous senator from Tennessee that himself is a guitar player and songwriter. And he actually busted out his guitar. We were in a conference room that held about 50 people, and he played something. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Was that like NARIS event or NSAI?
Maybe NSAI. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what they do. That's one of their primary missions, is lobbying in Washington for songwriters or publishers.
Follow-up question to Paul Croteau's earlier question. So as long as the AI generate does not sound substantially similar to a copyrighted work, I'm good to go. I can recreate and then own original music, vocal or instrumental. So now we're down to the underlying composition versus the sound recording. If it doesn't sound substantially similar. So I think the point Paul's making is, it gave me an idea, and I went down that road, but ended up amending so many things that it's no longer substantially similar. Is that kosher or not?
I think, yes, and the whole substantial similarity issue, I mean, look at the result we got in Blurred Lines, which I think was a horrible decision. And you put it in front of a jury, and they say, hey, they sound pretty close to me. And then we start doing the dissection of protected versus unprotectable elements. And the Ninth Circuit in California has allowed, going back to Isley Brothers and Michael Bolton, Love is a Wonderful Thing.
Right.
That case actually openly said that we can take a series of unprotected elements in the aggregate and still have a finding of infringement because of substantial similarity. I find that really troubling. So I say that again, not as an attorney, to Paul's question, but to be careful, you know, and you know, play it. Well, you're kind of letting the cat out of the bag if you play. Here's the original that I listened to before I wrote it. But Michael, you asked a question, you know, earlier. What if, you know, you and I are writing a song, or you and I go back to and we listen to a bunch of Beatles songs because there's something that we want. But, you know, are we ripping it off, or are we using it for inspiration? And I think that was actually what Blurred Lines was about. But the jury just said, nope, they sounded too close.
I, back in the day when I still worked in the studio, every time a new album came out of a band that I loved or something that impressed me, I remember I had a pair of JBL 4311s on the floor in my apartment, and I set them up, you know, right in front of me. I would lie in a prone position on the floor with the album cover, a spiral bound notebook, and write down about the guitar sound, the keyboard sound, mix elements, take all these different notes, and then sometimes read an interview with the engineer or producer and recording engineer producer magazine. And I kept all this stuff. And years later, I'd be working on something in the studio and I'd go, oh, I remember hearing that on a Fleetwood Mac album. I want to go see how they did that. And I would try and recreate the sound. I didn't rip off the part, but I did rip off the sound of drumsticks on a chair, and things that they did. So was,
yeah, and not sufficiently original to get you into infringement territory. You know, there's the idea, there's the expression of the idea and everything that comes with it. But can you own, you know, I put a timbali roll at the beginning of a song. You know, Rob Shirelli and I have talked about this, you know, with a drum intro. You know, somebody ripped off my drum intro, and it's like, well, too bad. Now, if they took a sample, now you're getting into the sound recording. But unless the drum intro itself is musically highly original, you might be getting in trouble for taking the recording if it's a sample, but not for taking, you know,
right.
Like, go for it.
Paul Croteau says again, the terms of Suno specifically state that paying members own the music that the tool generates. If you use the free version, Suno owns it. That's an interesting spin. It's,
well, I have the same thing. Actually, I cut it and pasted it into my notes here. Boomy says the exact same thing. And so think about this for a second. If we're leaning towards what the Copyright Office is saying, that AI-generated content is not ownable, you can't register the copyright of it, who gives a shit who owns it? Because nobody owns it. So I think, you know, but I also think, like, and to your follow-up point, Paul, and what I was bringing up, I had highlighted this on Boomy. It says, and this is, I don't even think they had an attorney write this, says Boomy Corporation owns and manages the copyright to songs created on the platform in order to comply with relevant copyright regulation. What the hell are they talking about?
That makes, I don't know, but they're setting themselves up to be sued.
Maybe.
They just assumed ownership, therefore taking you, the creator who used their tool, out of the line of fire.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. So I thought that was pretty funny. So they're treating the free version on both Boomy and Suno, that as people who are using that platform for free, we're treating you as work for hire, so we own the results. I think that's ridiculous. So I think that's going to get flushed out pretty soon.
And they had to hire, like, you know, a big time music attorney to check this stuff out. You would think
it doesn't sound like it.
I know.
So here's another one, that Boomy has a distribution deal with ADA, which that's Warner. So I thought that's interesting that here you have a major record label distributing shit that's generated from an AI platform. So. And we can talk about the UMG and TikTok thing too, but that's maybe a whole nother meeting. But okay, other questions?
Yeah, let's see. Any other questions? I saw one a minute ago. Where to go? Ralph Goldheim had a good question. Do you know if there's a watermark technology that anyone is suggesting?
I don't. Good question. I'm sure there are people lining up to try to, you know, get something that would be the default platform for doing that. But I don't know that. You know, I'm curious if some of the Shazam technology would be filtering down to some of this. I really don't know. Good question. Sorry.
That would be an interesting test. If Shazam, you know, like a lot of music libraries will Shazam something to see if there are any loops or a drum intro or whatever that's in somebody's piece that would make it uncopyrightable for one reason or another. I wonder if Shazam would find stuff that is not comprised of enough data that is like it. Even though it's not a sample, it's essentially a sample, like a drum turnaround or something. I don't know. But gosh, this is all mind-blowing. I'm going to try and not think of it when I get into bed tonight.
Yeah, some of this stuff is going to be AI is going to generate some of the answers to these questions. Right?
Yeah. Super Blonde says in the chat room, Michael has enough videos on YouTube to generate an AI of himself to host the show forever in his absence. That's a good one, Super Blonde. I like that.
Yeah.
Less work for me. Wow. All right. I think they're out of questions. Comments, but no questions. Come on. Anybody want to type the word question in all caps? We've still got 4.5 minutes to go.
I'm seeing if there's anything that I highlighted in my notes that I want to circle back to.
I've got a fair use question for you that I've always meant to ask music attorney friends of mine, and I always forget, which is I've got early recordings of some major artists that are in my possession, and if I were to play that stuff that a version of it came out on a record, but not that version, or maybe this was the acoustic guitar and vocal that led to a more fleshed out version. Can I use that in any sort of educational way on one of my Taxi TV videos on YouTube, or will I get shut down on that as a copyright strike?
Well, let's just kind of narrow or clarify the use. So would this be something that you might play at a road rally?
I'm sure I could play it in a ballroom, probably, because that's ephemeral and it's not up there, you know, forever on YouTube. I'm thinking more specifically of YouTube.
Oh, okay. Well, there are a couple things, and YouTube is a difficult example because YouTube kind of has the opt-in, opt-out thing, which is their Band-Aid for getting around infringement beyond the takedown compliance, which is just, as far as I'm concerned, it's a Band-Aid. So if you put something up, the question, there are two parts, again, the two copyrights. Do you have permission to use the song? Do you have permission to use the recording? If it's not public domain, who owns the recording? I mean, are these demos that, like the Marvin Gaye stuff that fell into your lap? But if it's strictly a fair use question, let's just say it's you know, a well-known song from a well-known artist, and it was a demo, and you don't have permission to use it. So you asked if it's a fair use. If it's educational, even the statute, it says, you know, research, commentary, First Amendment, educational purposes. So if it's truly an educational purpose, although Taxi is a for-profit company, so, I mean, these little details might come into the issue as far as commercial use versus
so bottom line is I'm gonna spend my house defending myself in court. Don't mess with it. Side of the law, you can still be sued.
Oh, yeah. And you might even win, but it's still going to cost you to fight it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right.
So one last thing. I know we're just about out of time, but I was going to mention also AI non-music. Is there are a couple major lawsuits, class action suits, where very high-level book authors are suing OpenAI and Microsoft, including the people that wrote the book that the Oppenheimer movie was based on.
Right.
John Grisham is in on this. So because these are the AI platforms that are being used to generate books and scripts using well-known books by well-known authors to train their model.
So somebody said, we're out of time. Somebody said, could you repeat today's title and address that? The title was, how worried should you be about AI in the music industry? What's your answer to that? How worried should the people watching today's episode be?
Well, it depends on which side of the coin you're on, you know. If you're using AI to generate music, I would say be very cautious in to what degree the output that you're getting is going to be what you're going to put out there into the world. You know, back to my example of my student that's using it for suggestions in his lyric writing, I think he's going to be fine. But if you're going to go fake Drake on this, then you should be very concerned about what you're putting out in the world.
What about, I think their concern is, are they going to be replaced by a robot?
I saw an interesting article just in the last week about certain sectors of employment that are speculated to be devastated by AI. So I don't have an answer for you, but I think there is valid cause for concern. Michael, you and I talked briefly about it, about library music, you know, being AI generated, where it's not going to be something where the library goes away, but a film or television production company just generates their own background music because they don't have to hire a composer. I'm sure we're going to be seeing that. So on the real creativity, I've talked to a bunch of songwriters about this and just saying, I still haven't heard the AI generated song that's a real fucking hit. And it's coming, you know, it's definitely coming. But, you know, my suggestion to anybody who's on the creative side is just do really great work. Do work that's from your heart, that moves people. You know, somebody's always going to want a great song. I'd say, eyes wide open, you know, heads up, just make great work. I also wanted to give a plug for Rick Rubin's book on creativity. It's amazing.
I actually wrote a post-it note when you told me about that over the weekend, yeah. And then now I can't find the post-it note. Rick Rubin book.
Yeah, it's called The Creative Act. It's a way of being. It's really, really good. So I just brought up Rick Rubin because, you know, be creative, write great stuff, practice your craft. You know, I just have to say at some point, you know, if a machine can write as good a song, fuck it, just write more good songs.
And there's the quote, ladies and gentlemen. Todd, I cannot thank you enough.
This is fun.
Really, really, really good information. There's been so much stuff out there. I've heard about AI. Much of it is people just freaking out and guessing at a lot of stuff. You've actually studied a lot and great input. I would love to have you back again in a couple of months because things will progress, I'm sure.
They will.
And enjoy your upcoming retirement. I'm envious of you and proud of you and have always appreciated your friendship. And thank you. And I want to mention next week, a very good mutual friend of ours, Rob Shirelli, will be my guest on Taxi TV. So don't miss that, ladies and gents. Once again, Mr. Todd Harriman, thank you.
Long fade. And you know, it was Rob Shirelli that introduced us.